It seems only yesterday we were celebrating the 70th anniversary of Orwell's 1984. British author Dorian Lynskey came onto the program to talk about how Orwell invented Big Brother and the nightmare world of the thought police, and explained why 1984 resumed its relevance on the bestseller list just weeks after the election of the Donald. Now, since then, innumerable articles have written describing the world we live in as Orwellian, but it turns out that our use of the term may need to be revised because my next guest, the American author and activist Rebecca Solnit, has been researching Orwell's past and she's discovered a very different side to him. Now, before we dig into her new book, Orwell's Roses, let me just say a few words to introduce the author. Rebecca is an immensely prolific author who's written more than 20 books, including Wanderlust, Hope in the Dark, Men Explain Things to Me, and her recent memoir, Recollections of My Non-Existence. She's a regular contributor to The Guardian and has written countless essays on feminism, activism and the climate crisis. The last time we talked was way back in 2009, and so I'm delighted that she's found time to come back to the program online now from San Francisco to talk about Orwell's Roses. Rebecca, great to have you on the program again.
Lovely to be slightly in Australia.
I was in introducing the program, I was talking about famous gardeners, the likes of Einstein, who loved fussing around in his little greenhouse. And, of course, Napoleon and Josephine were dotty about roses, but I didn't realise that Orwell was too.
I didn't. Well, I knew it to some extent. Orwell wrote a wonderful essay in 1946 called A Good Word for the Vicar of Bray, in which he casually mentions going back to see the garden he had planted 10 years earlier and seeing the fruit trees and roses thriving and thinking of, you know, these cheap things he bought at Woolworths as saplings and starters, and how the planting of a tree, he writes, particularly a hardwood tree, will outlast anything else you do, good or bad. So I knew that he gardened, but I always thought that essay and the gardening were some sign of who he might have been had he not been living through world wars and the rise of fascism and other crises. But it turns out, despite all those things, that's exactly who he was. He was an avid anti-fascist and an avid gardener.
I love the story about you being on a book tour in the UK in the summer of 2017, and you set off on a detour to try and find his fruit trees.
I like that I'm talking to an Australian, because who else would call November 2nd the summer? I was on tour, and I had been talking to a friend about who got very excited about whether those fruit trees written about in this I just mentioned were growing. So I got off the train in Baldock several stops before Cambridge, where I was going to talk with my friend Rob McFarlane, and took a taxi. I was actually quite unwell. It was a tour I was not supposed to be on, except for an evil contract. And so I went, took a taxi. Later on, I would walk the 3 miles to the cottage from the train. And not knowing what I would find, whether there would be fruit trees, whether I would get a door slammed in my face. And the lovely people who lived in the cottage welcomed me, brought me in, told me the fruit trees had been cut down. I thought that was the end of the story. And it was, for what my friend thought he was interested in. But then they casually mentioned, oh, but you know, Orwell's roses are still growing. Would you like to see them? And they took me round to look at these big unruly rose bushes blooming away in November. And as we say in the States, it kind of blew my mind, both because it made Orwell present in a way that being, you know, with a living thing that had been with him when he was himself a living thing does, but also because I realized I'd never thought hard enough about what those roses meant. Fruit trees can be rationalized by all kinds of utilitarian and socialist lines of thinking because they produce practical stuff, namely food, even though they produce so much more. But roses planted on that scale can only be planted for pleasure and beauty and joy. And it just raised all these questions about, well, who was Orwell and what was this all about? And the more I looked, the more I found an Orwell that wasn't the grim, stern, austere, pessimistic figure we're all so familiar with. And it felt worth telling the world about.
Well, you know, Rebecca, I'm delighted on behalf of readers everywhere that you've made this deep connection to the natural world visible to us. He was a lot more cheerful than he's been given credit for.
Absolutely. And I wrote this book really, and it's a curiosity that Orwell took so much more pleasure in life and devoted himself so much more wholeheartedly to all these small and not so small pleasures, gardening, fishing, wandering around the countryside, a good cup of tea, a good pub, nursery rhymes, fairy tales. And he took so much pleasure in so many things. Naughty Postcards was the subject of a major essay of his. But I felt like it was really instructive because we often think that either you're a dabbler and a dilettante or a very serious person. And part of what was interesting to me is that Orwell was undoubtedly a very serious person. And if he can do all these other things, we're all off the hook in a way. And, you know, there are two things, one of which is I believe that often in order to do the really important work we're here to do on Earth, you may need to do stuff that seems trivial, irrelevant, self-indulgent, beside the point, luxurious, you know, lightweight, all those things people will damn you with. When Orwell wrote for the Socialist Magazine Tribune, a woman wrote in hilariously that she thought flowers were bourgeois. And, you know, but you may need to do those things to do your really important work. But also I felt like Orwell surprisingly took good care of himself while working incredibly hard against fascism, totalitarianism, propaganda and lies, and wrote the best novel of the 20th century about all those things. And so, you know, the relationship between those things was significant. And I thought it raised questions for me in our own difficult time of how we might live our lives, what it takes to be committed in the long term. And it might take pacing yourself and doing other things. But also a lot of these pleasures are not so disconnected from the serious work. They're often the things we're defending. And as climate activists, we're defending nature and, you know, the sort of beautiful orderliness of the world. If we don't spend time contemplating it, if we lose sight of what we're doing, I think we can become embittered, become mirrors of what we oppose, get lost in various ways. So there's a lot of reasons why Orwell's passionate gardening and involvement in all these other things was really interesting to me, as well as the fact that what he called facing unpleasant facts, looking hard at the worst things in the world, didn't embitter or sour him or make him an utterly miserable person, that he seemed to mix it up well with all this other stuff. And he's a man who died young of tuberculosis, but with a fishing rod in his room, because he was still hopeful that he might get well enough to go to a Swiss sanatorium and get a little bit of fishing in.
Rebecca, I've been sitting at this microphone, well, for over 30 years, and one of my first guests and a continuing friend of the program until we had a monumental falling out was Christopher Hitchens. And, of course, Christopher was an absolute addict of Orwell, and I wish he was alive today because he would be forced to reread 1984, as I am, as a consequence of your work, and of course, as you have to do.
I only saw Christopher Hitchens once, and it was in 2003, and he was talking about his good friend Ahmed Chalabi, who had assured him there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And that about covers my opinion of Christopher Hitchens, who is one of a lot of people who assumed because Orwell was critical of the left that he was could somehow be made over as a conservative.
But of course, he is claimed by both sides of politics, isn't he?
Yeah, well, and one side is wrong. It's the very short version. You know, Orwell was very critical of the parts of the left that I think If the left is going to be about equality and human rights, it ceased to be the left when it had become Stalinist, had become complicit in, lies and propaganda and show trials and gulags and torture and all the rest. And Orwell was critical of them because he was defending the left because he was passionately committed to it as a democratic socialist, as somebody who once described himself as a Tory anarchist, and who was very critical of, the kind of capitalism and the conservatives, imperialism and the rest. So the right may enjoy claiming him, but their evidence that he would agree, I think, is missing.
Rebecca, you open your book with Winston Smith pulling out a notebook and luxuriating in the creamy texture of the paper.
One of the joys of writing this book is I reread 1984, which I've been reading every now and again since I was a teenager, which was quite a while ago. And finding a completely different book than the one I thought I knew pretty well, looking at Orwell, looking at his roses, reading his diaries and letters, finding this person who was a lot more cheerful, but also much more deeply grounded in the world of the senses, let me see that 1984 isn't about what totalitarianism is as much as it's about what totalitarianism tries to destroy and what resistance looks like. And Orwell, I think, believes that a lot of what Winston does, which is independent thinking, memory, passion, his passionate love affair, solitude, and little acts of rebellion like keeping a diary, but also just a deep grounding in the senses, may not be the kind of resistance that topples a regime, but might be the kind of resistance that forms a robust, independent-minded person who can resist when the time comes. There's a crucial sentence in there that became important to me for this book, where he says, "The final command of the party was to ignore the evidence of your eyes and ears," which reminds me a lot of the Trump administration, but then most things in 1984 do. But what's fascinating about that is you can reverse engineer it and say, well, then trusting the evidence of your senses is resistance. And you do that by going out into the world, by paying attention, by, a kind of empiricism and engagement. And Winston does that in so many ways. And it was striking to me that he doesn't just begin the book with Winston writing a journal, but luxuriating in the quality of the paper and the process of dipping an old ink pen in an inkwell, and also the kind of voluptuousness of having an inner life of expressing thoughts, and the hopefulness that maybe he's writing his thoughts to communicate with people in the future. And so the book is full of that, and it has birdsong and the golden country and the love affair and all these moments. And then
eating a bit of forbidden chocolate, for example.
Oh, yeah, and makeup and lots of sex. And Orwell writes, desire was thought crime. The sex act successfully performed was an act of rebellion. I don't know what he has against the sex act unsuccessfully performed, but it really suggests also that just all this stuff that makes a strong, independent person, a person with connections to the world around them, to other people, to the past, to hope for the future, to the natural world, to history. All these things don't topple a regime, but they make people who can resist and topple a regime. And in a funny way, the book is recounting all that. And what was also striking for me is what for me is the climactic passage of the book, which, to my shock when I read it again, leans on a roses metaphor. Just before the thought police come and take Winston away from the little room he's been renting for his love affair, he looks out the window, and it's happened twice before, and sees this stout, middle-aged Cockney washerwoman singing in a beautiful voice and hanging out diapers. And he has this thought, which I think is new to Orwell as well as to him, that he sees for the first time that she's beautiful, and then he thinks she must have had a girlhood like a young blooming rose, and then thinks, but why should the rose be inferior to the rose? and sees her as the rosehip, as part of this kind of biological progression. But I think, and she's this powerful figure singing her sentimental song that's about lost love, hanging out those diapers, that's taking care of the rising generations, and just her sturdiness. Winston says more than once, if there's hope, it lies with the proles. And 1984 is often read as a novel of defeat because Winston is destroyed. But I don't think Orwell thought hope lay with Winston. Winston was just the aware, the sentient being who he could narrate the story through. I think that the washerwoman is really standing for, that kind of resilience, that biological resilience and emotional resilience, and these people treated as beneath notice who may topple the regime. And as Margaret Atwood points out, the appendix at the end of the book makes it clear that the regime doesn't last forever. And it's written with newspeak and all the rest in the past tense.
My guest for the second time in 15 years is Rebecca Solnit, author of Orwell's Roses. And through her eyes, you realize that there's a dreamlike quality to much of 1984. Tell me about the time in his life when he moved from London and went off to live in the cottage.
Yeah, in 1936, he took a job that turned into his book, The Road to Wigan Pier, reporting on the condition of the working class in the industrial north in England, looking at the unemployed, the mine workers, the grim living conditions of people in these utterly befouled landscapes, black and dead with coal, going down into the mines. And it's really, along with his journey at the other end of 1936 to Spain to fight in the Spanish Civil War, what made him the man he was, what made him the writer he was, what made him the leftist he was. It's what really shook him out of his kind of schoolboy snarkiness into becoming a dedicated, person trying to be in solidarity, being socialist, etc. And so when he came straight back from that adventure in the north to rent a tiny cottage his aunt had found for him in Wallington, the one that I visited, and started setting about to have the life that he had long wanted. He was engaged and was also setting up a home so he could get married. He was going to try and make a living as a writer for the first time. He'd been a schoolmaster and bookstore clerk after quitting his job in the Burmese Imperial Police. And and he raised he set up a garden, partly because he was going to be really poor for a long time with his writing, and he raised a lot of his own food, but he also clearly loved gardening. He answered a writer's questionnaire in 1940 with a statement, "After writing, the thing I care about most is gardening, particularly vegetable gardening," which is a pretty strong statement, although most of the people who've written about him haven't been very interested in the gardening.
He describes the deadness of the districts in which almost nothing grew and everything was fouled with coal. Heavens above, it's got new symbolism, of course, in the era of climate change. So despite all the wealth that coal brought for the manufacturing class, the poverty he observed was heartbreaking. So his need, his psychological, even his physical need, I guess, for relief, for release, was to be found in his little garden.
Yeah, and not that little. He rented some more land to spread out his vegetable garden, grazed a goat or two upon the common, had a bunch of chickens whose eggs he sold. He was producing about 100 eggs a week and was really pretty industrious with all of this as well as the writing. And it felt like going straight from the coal mines to the garden was really, in a way, almost trying to find what is the opposite of that hellscape of deadness and making something wonderfully alive. And of course, Orwell spent his whole adult life postponing dying of lung diseases, and which had afflicted him since he was a child. So I think that he was both more alive than people who mistakenly think they're immortal, and more aware how fleeting it might be, and really kind of seize the day.
You explore another aspect of his writing where he talks about being so aware of where luxuries came from. He writes about the plantations, for example, in far-flung corners of the empire that enabled people to put sugar in their tea.
Yeah, he says that you can have independence for India or sugar in your tea, although I'm not sure British sugar was coming from India. It might have been coming still from the Caribbean, and he might have been so self-conscious about sugar because his great-great-grandfather and the ancestors before owned slave plantations in Jamaica that were producing sugar under the most horrific conditions imaginable. Orwell, is just his father was an opium agent in India. His grandfather was his mother's father was a teak merchant cutting down Burmese trees for profit in Burma. So Orwell has a deeply imperialist background and that an imperialism that consisted of exploiting other parts of the world and exploiting plants for profit.
Rebecca, was that perhaps one of the reasons he's changed his name from Eric Blair?
I don't think that he was particularly ashamed of the slave-owning ancestor. He actually, as a young man, was weirdly anti-Scottish, and Blair, of course, is a Scottish name. He might have wanted to not embarrass his family or just distance himself from his family. It does feel like a chance to reinvent himself, and a lot of people knew him as Eric Blair, all the rest of his life. It's what it says on his tombstone. There might have been various reasons he wanted a nom de plume or nom de guerre.
As part of your writing and thinking about roses, you went off to visit a flower farm in Colombia. Was that trip inspired by, Orwell's visits to the coal mines in the north of England?
It actually wasn't, although I know there's a nice echo there. Even before I had run into Orwell's roses, even before this book was generated, I knew that most of the roses sold in the United States were grown in Colombia under horrific conditions. And I wanted to go for a couple of reasons. I wanted to look at roses at the other end of the spectrum. It's very easy to think roses are lovely and beautiful and delightful, but they can also be a mass-produced commodity under hideous environmental and working conditions, and they certainly are when they come from these African and South American, sort of greenhouse sweatshops for the European and American markets. And I also wanted to think about the relationship between the ethical and the aesthetic, which it's easy not to think about in this era where we don't have to think about where our energy and our iPhones, our clothes, our food, et cetera, come from. How do you think about something like a dozen roses that might still be visually beautiful but are morally reprehensible? It's something Orwell was really interested in, and it was also an excuse to think about Orwell's own kind of exploration of aesthetic and ethical relationships.
You managed to get into one of the rose plantations and saw the workers in something as factory-like as any of the Manchester mills in 1870.
Yeah, and they also had to wear these coveralls with peppy slogans on them that clearly were not their sentiments. And if the word Orwellian is overused, but forcing people who are utterly exploited, not allowed to organize, have no benefits, many of whom will get chronic stress injuries from repetitive motions, to wear all these cheerful slogans about how much they love their job and what a wonderful place they're working in, could be called Orwellian.
A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. In another chapter in your book, you investigate the origins of the phrase bread and roses. Tell me where it comes from and how it links to Orwell.
Yeah, and this book meanders quite a bit if people hadn't figured that out yet. I think most of us know the phrase bread and roses. I did without really understanding it until I looked into its origins. In 1910, a woman organizing for women's voting rights was on a lecture tour in Illinois in the American Midwest. She stayed on a farm that seemed to only have women on it, and a bedridden old woman, her daughter, and the servant girl. And the servant girl came and heard her give her talk. And she had talked about, you know, if women got the vote, there would be bread for all and flowers too. And the servant girl called that phrase out as the one she really liked. And somehow the conversation these four women had pulled the phrase out into high relief. And that, I believe, is the origin of the phrase bread and roses. And although we all know the phrase, I didn't really understand what it meant. It's actually a very radical and subtle manifesto saying that not only do we demand bread for everyone, which is what most kind of labor, working class, human rights movements do, bread being the basics of life, food, clothing, shelter, security, but roses demands that everybody have the right to nature, culture, beauty, leisure, and really demands something much more subtle and complex and also very much more individual. We can more or less all get by on the same food, clothing, and shelter, but what our idea of beauty and pleasure and culture and nature might be is going to vary a lot from person to person. So it's also defending a kind of liberty and privacy in which we get to decide what the roses are. And then, of course, the phrase gets picked up. James Oppenheim writes the famous poem that gets set to music, which ultimately Mimi Farina and Joan Baez would sing. And Mimi Farina founds the Bread and Roses organization that brings music to people in institutions from prisons to hospitals. And the labor movement takes up Bread and Roses as a kind of cry. But I don't think most people remember what it really means. And it's funny because you do have people who are of the left writing in with things like flowers are bourgeois. And so demanding bread and roses is actually quite an antithetical stance, saying that flowers should be for everyone, beauty should be for everyone, culture, nature, pleasure should be for everyone. And I love it also because you see so often people trying to treat the roses half of the equation as superfluous, unnecessary, indulgent. So to see these radicals of the early 20th century absolutely demanding it and making roses equal to bread was pretty exhilarating.
Earlier, you talked about arriving at the cottage and fearful of having a door closed in your face. In fact, you were invited inside and given a cup of tea. And Orwell loved a good cup of tea, didn't he?
He wrote a very funny little essay in 1946 about how to make a proper cup of tea, and he had very rigid ideas about it, which I disagree with because I put the milk in first myself, which is a bit like Gulliver's Travels and the Big Indians and Little Indians, but there will be no war. But he wrote a whole host of essays in late 1945 and into 1946. You know, he's living in London. He's just been widowed. He's a single father. His health is abominable. London is in ruins from the Blitz. His mother has died just before. And he's writing all these really kind of life-affirming essays about ordinary pleasures. And I think he's doing it partly because he has to make a living. And writing about these things he can just reminisce about is one of the easier things he can do. And, you know, and he may be needing to remind himself as well as others of it. And he's always celebrating things that are accessible to almost anyone.
He writes for me, yeah, about the pleasure of junk shops, which he differentiates from antique shops for their, quote, dusty obscurity and their broken items of no value. I mean, he was a wonderful observer.
Yeah, and one of the things I love about that junk shops essay, again, the kind of people who think flowers are bourgeois might say that the junk shop essay is very trivial, whereas 1984 is a very serious book. But it's in the junk shops that he finds the coral paperweights, the glass paperweights with bits of coral in, which become a central symbol in 1984. And that's one of the things that's always fun for me as a writer. You know, you're wandering around junk shops. Not only will you get an essay about it someone will pay you for, but you might get an emblem that will become crucial to something much more important. And 1984 is the great anti-totalitarian novel. And, you know, wandering around in junk shops was part of his research for it, and enjoying looking at, you know, knickknacks and old dusty things and glass paperweights with bits of coral in them. And so it all links up. You can see that he's also kind of rehearsing a lot of the pleasures that will be the pleasures of 1984 in these essays. But there's a whole sort of collection of essays written in this period just before he leaves London for the Isle of Jura and the Hebrides and begins writing 1984, that together are really so celebratory and so surprising, given what the condition of the world and the condition of Orwell's own health and life.
I have to tell you that you're as magical with words as George, and I thank you so much, Rebecca, for coming on. Rebecca Solnit, a writer, historian, and activist, and this wonderful book is called Orwell's Roses, and it's published by Granta. Come back soon, Rebecca. And that's your lot for the week, beloved listeners. Thanks to our executive producer, Anna Whitfeld, producers Anne Arnold, Ian Coombe, Jackie Dent, Joey Watson, and Julie Street. Sound by Bryce Halliday and Roy Huberman. And next week is our last week of live programming for the year.